So we are continuing in the Beatitudes. We are walking, by the way, cool for the Sermon on the Mount, right? Trees and whatnot. If you weren't here last week, this is a theater set. There's a play actively going on in the theater this month. And so we have not reset the stage, but it kind of works. Maybe they'll leave the trees for us for a couple weeks afterwards. Pastor Rick, what do you think? Yes, no, maybe. Pastor Rick is not talking anymore. He's trying to figure out what happened up there. Okay, so last week we established not a lot, like just the setting, the significance, the importance as Jesus climbed up the mountain and took people with him up the mountain, exactly what was being established as he lays out this blueprint or doctrine for the kingdom of God. And really focused in on the word blessed, and that it wasn't Baruch, it wasn't a blessing like we speak the blessing over everyone at the end of service, but it was this Hebrew word Ashrei that means the place of human flourishing. The Bible Project calls it the good life, and that it isn't about what's happening, but God's presence in the place where things are happening. And really beginning to grasp that as we walk into the first several Beatitudes that we're going to tackle today. And so if the Beatitudes, I'll remind you, are the coordinates of where we find God at work. So again, we're not saying the blessing is in the death of a loved one when you grieve, or the blessing is in your broken heart. That's not it. The blessing is in God's presence that comforts you and leads you and guides you in those places. And so I want to invite us to read together Matthew 5, 3 through 5, as we look at the first three Beatitudes Jesus gives us. Are you guys ready for that? I don't know about y'all, but I need some Ashrei in my life. I need to be reminded, like, the enemy has been busy this week attacking. I'm just going to tell you, like, so busy, and glory to God, Jesus has the victory. But I need to be reminded that in all of those spaces and places, we are Ashrei because God's presence is there. So I want to invite you to read with me. I'm just going to come over here and we're going to read these first couple verses. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. And blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Started reading that and thought, I need to be saying blessed. It's the same word, but it feels different, you know? All right. So let's tackle these and let's see what Jesus is really talking to us. Because he's spent some time establishing Ashrei, his presence, and the importance as he gathered the people. So I just want you to picture yourself. Matter of fact, if I go back up into the first two verses, it says, Jesus saw the crowds and he went up on a mountainside and sat down, and the disciples came to him and he began to teach them. Remember that the crowds were also there, like we see at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, that all the crowds were amazed. So there's this circle Jesus has set up at the top of the mountain where the disciples and then the disciples of the disciples and the people who have come to hear. And I just want you to understand that Jesus has invited me and you and our family online to sit in that circle and receive his word today. So I wasn't going to share this, and I think I'm supposed to, as I set that scene for you about Jesus inviting you up to the mountain. When Pastor Rick and I went to Israel as part of our seminary trip, we went up to the mountain where it said Jesus preached the Sermon on the Mount from. They have a, it's not a church so much as a sanctuary kind of set up there that they've built. And this artist has done his rendering of the nine Beatitudes and incorporated that into nine windows that look out, one for each thing. And we were to take some quiet devotion time in that space. And what God impressed on me as I prayed and I journaled, and I have my journal, like I treasure my journal from that time, was that as Jesus looked out and he talked about the poor in spirit and those who mourn and everything that he would go on to list, he wasn't just seeing the crowd in front of him, but he was seeing the poor in spirit from the beginning of time to the end of time. That he looked out across that hillside and he saw where I fit in the brokenhearted. And he saw where you fit in your mourning. He saw all of our faces. And it was so, like, I was journaling, weeping. Like, that's not me. First of all, I'm not much of a journaler. My longtime friends will attest to that. And I was just weeping at the grace of God that Jesus would take the time to see us and feel what we feel and minister to us. And so from that space, I invite you to gather up to the mountain as we hear what Jesus has to teach us. The good life belongs to the poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. The Greek word for poor is tokos. It means lacking resources, needy, destitute, depending on others for support. People without economic means, social stability, or resources. And the Greek word for spirit, because it's poor in spirit, that's a phrase. The Greek word is pneuma, but what I want us and need us to understand is that while Jesus was speaking Greek because it was the language of the day, he was speaking Hebrew foundations of faith. And so he did not view spirit as the Greeks viewed spirit as pneuma, but he would have viewed it as ruach, which is the very breath of God that God breathed into us. It's the spirit of God that hovered over the waters. It is the invisible energy, the energy and vitality that we as humans are animated with, the breath of God that he breathed in once he formed us out of the dust of the earth. And so what does it mean to be poor in spirit? It's this phrase that it represents people who are without spiritual influence. They're without significance. They're without spiritual wealth, so to speak. But they're also often without physical wealth. They're also often without physical influence in life. We get to the place where we're poor in spirit because there are things of lack and missing, and poor in spirit represents both the physical and the spiritual that would leave someone hopeless. Jesus looks out at this hillside and he is talking to an impoverished people who are suffering under Roman authority, some of them Jews, some of them Gentiles. You had fishermen, you had shepherds, you had thieves. One of the commentaries I read pointed out you had sex workers, you had everybody. You had those who weren't welcomed in the temple, who the religious leaders and religious elite would not have felt clean sitting down with. And Jesus looked out at them. And in their poverty, understand that poverty destroys hope. Poverty devours hope in our lives. And those who are poor in spirit would be those whose poverty has removed all of their human hope. And the only hope that they have left is that God would intervene. They're hanging on to God and God alone to show up. And understand this, to be poor in spirit does not mean to think you're worthless. Not at all. But it is to admit that you're not enough. To be poor in spirit is to recognize that while I have value to God, I in myself am not enough to do anything about this current situation and state that I'm in. And it's when we get to that place that we can look at God, kind of like that honest conversation that he invited Peter into that we talked about on Easter, when we can admit to God where we're actually at, when we can stop pretending we're enough, when we can stop striving to be enough, when we can stop blaming other people that we're not enough, and we can go to God and admit we have nothing to give, that is the space where God begins to do tremendous and miraculous work in our hearts and in our lives. I want you to remember that to have nothing to offer in this culture meant you didn't have sacrifices to make at the temple. To live under Roman rule that was taking all the money and leaving people impoverished and without food, they would have to choose whether to eat or to purchase a sacrifice or to take, are they going to take the dove that is their protein for the week and sacrifice it at the temple for an offering? And what if they don't have a dove that week? Then can they go to the temple and be welcomed and do these things that have been set up for them to do? And now we have Jesus turning everything upside down, showing up to those people in their nothingness, their lackness of things to offer him. And he says, the kingdom of heaven is yours. You who have nothing to bring to the temple, the kingdom itself is for you. And y'all, that is profound. Let's step into today, church. You who have nothing to bring to Jesus, but your honest hearts, the kingdom belongs to you. The kingdom belongs to me. Because I've got nothing without him. Nothing. The kingdom of heaven. Heaven is God's space, right? Like the place in their minds, and even today, heaven is God's space where he fully exists, where there's no hiding of who God is, where there's no separation. And while he has always been, since the time of Eden when the kingdom was separated from the earth, he's always been close by. Jesus is saying, no, he's not just close by anymore, and he's not just for the high priest in this one spot. Jesus says, I am introducing a time and a place where you don't have to go to God. The kingdom is literally coming to you. It belongs to you. By the way, we're not going to have a lot of points up on the slides today. It's not happening. It's been a week, let me tell you. So if you're a note taker, take notes. And if you're not a note taker, maybe think about taking notes. Those who have nothing to offer God but themselves receive everything God has to offer. Those who have nothing to offer God but themselves receive everything God has to offer. Well, if that didn't turn things upside down and begin to cause a rustle and a ruffle across the crowd, Jesus goes on. Those who mourn will be comforted. The word that he uses is the strongest word for grief or mourning in the Greek language. There are multiple words for grief or mourning. This word, pentheo, represented deep, painful, unthinkable grief. The kind of grief where you just can't get up from it. The kind of grief that is a weight that sits on you. It is a soul deep lamenting that takes place. It's a gut-wrenching grief. I don't know if you've been there yet or not, but I want to encourage you that Jesus will meet you there and you'll need him to. You know, I think back, and many of you know I had lived in a very abusive, negative childhood, but for my granddad. He was my whole world. And when my granddad died, I wasn't in church. Like, I had been saved, but walked away, and I wasn't in church. And I got to tell you, when both your parents have abandoned you, when life has been more brutally hard than any of you needs for me to describe for sure, and that person is gone, and I didn't have Jesus to cling to because I wasn't focused on him, I wasn't going to him, I wasn't trying to say, I can't do this, you've got to do this. My grief was so overwhelming when he died. I was in the third semester of Arabic at the Defense Language Institute. You know, Middle Easterners know how to mourn, right? Like, they do it well, whether they are Jewish or Arabic, they grieve. And I remember one of my professors calling me into her office. She was a Palestinian woman. She was hard. And she used my Arabic name, Thareya. She said, Thareya, I've never seen a human being grieve like you have grieved over this last month. I'm worried for you. That's what deep grief looks like without Jesus. Can I tell you, don't go there. Cling to Jesus now. Be poor in spirit now. Learn to hold on and depend on him now. Because when the grief comes, and someday it will, it's a totally different grief now. And I want to stress again, the ashrei, the blessing, the good life, it's not found because the person died. It's found because God is present and comforts in our grief. And I want us to see the connection to the first statement, because Jesus first talks to the people who are poor in spirit, and they're broken and they don't have anything, and they're destitute and they're impoverished. And you know what? Grief hits harder and more frequently when that is your life. When you live in an occupied land, when you live under socioeconomic stress and oppression, when you don't have anything to distract you from your grief. See, not only do people who are living in poverty and poverty of spirit tend to experience more grief because there's more loss and there's more death and there's more going without, but they also don't have power and wealth and things to distract them when it is time to grieve. This is actually one of the things that benefits us, dare I say? Because as a culture, we tend to run away from grief. And we tend to use all our power and all our wealth and all our devices. I'm grieving something, so I'm going to scroll, I'm going to binge watch a show, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that, and I'm not going to sit with my feelings where God is actually showing up in our feelings. It's like God is sitting in the recliner waiting for you going, child, I know you've got tremendous grief to process. Could you stop the YouTube scroll and watching? Could you not binge watch yet another season of something? Could you actually come over here? Because I want to heal your heart. I want to tend to your heart. I want to minister to your heart. Stop running away from it, because it's just going to keep. All right, I don't think Jesus says it's just going to keep biting you in the bum, but I'm going to say it's just going to keep biting you in the bum until you deal with it, right? Because that's what it does. And not only is there this personal aspect that he's speaking to, but this is a communal culture. Right? They work together. They don't think as individuals. And Jesus is talking about, yes, personal grief, but there's also the communal aspect that the ashrei, the good life, belongs to those, yes, who experience death and loss personally, but also to those who understand that the state of the world around us is worth grieving for. That the state of their world in the Roman culture where they lived under occupation, that the state of what was happening for them, that the state of the society as a whole was worth grieving for. And Jesus sets the example for this as he has great compassion for the people. He's moved with grief when his own cousin has been executed. Jesus is so moved with compassion and grief for the people and their lostness that he ministers to them anyway. when he stands up over Jerusalem as they're about to crucify him. He mourns, Jerusalem, my Jerusalem. He grieves for this city who is so lost. Church, Jesus wants us to see and to feel and to be devastated for the things of the world that are broken and break his heart. For the broken lives around us. And can I tell you, in our very divided nation, in our very divided political world, you don't have to agree with the reason someone is grieving to sit with them in their grief. You don't have to agree with the ideology of the hurt that they are presenting to you to see that they are genuinely in pain and to sit with them in their pain and to be the hands and feet of Jesus. See, the enemy constantly tries to divide us, even with grief. And Jesus says, no, no, no. Because it's in that very space where the powerless are mourning that the presence of God turns grief into sacred ground. That's the sacred space that we talked about last week. It's the sacred space that was encountered by Corrie ten Boom and Dietrich Bonhoeffer, by Dr. King, by Mahatma Gandhi. It's this sacred space where God shows up in our grief and then motivates us to do something about it. We're going to get to that as we move on, but there was a song by Hillsong called Hosanna. And the lyric in it, and I just kept hearing it over and over as I prepared this part of the message this week, was break my heart for what breaks yours. Everything I am, God, for your kingdom's cause. And that's how Jesus takes grief and turns it into sacred ground. And if that's not enough, he goes on to say, the good life belongs to the meek, for they will inherit the earth. We have to understand meek or pros in Greek. The concept he's communicating is the Hebrew ani. And the ani are the unimportant or afflicted, the overlooked or discarded. But they are also those who in those places accept and are obedient to God's guidance. You have to understand that meekness is not weakness. We mischaracterize it in our culture all the time because we like to be the big, strong Americans. Just bow up and be courageous, right? And meekness doesn't mean that you're not courageous. It doesn't mean weakness. It portrays the person who has learned to trust God to be the provider in their circumstance instead of trusting themselves. And when he says they will inherit the earth, these people that are sitting out in front of him, most of them don't own land. Land ownership was everything for security and wealth and legacy and sustainment. And the very land, the promised land, had been taken over by Rome. And the people were impoverished. And land ownership in that day was like our 401k today, right? If you don't have one, you're going to be in trouble. And you're going to continue to be enslaved to whatever's going to come. And Jesus says, they will inherit the earth. And it's not just any land. He's referencing the promised land, the very land that's been taken from them. And what they don't realize yet is it's a much bigger stage, because the promised land becomes for everyone and all of us and not just limited to this one geographic space, but it's the kingdom itself that exists everywhere where God is. And so for us as children of God, he's talking about our inheritance, our spiritual inheritance in him that we get as children of God. And in that, he's not asking the meek to sit back and do nothing. He's saying, trust me that you've got your inheritance. I've got you. And now you can live with whatever your circumstance is, actually not weakly, but courageously, because you have confidence that what I have promised you, the promised land, the inheritance, the kingdom that I have promised you and given you a deposit on, you are going to actually walk in. Can I tell you that meekness protects our character? I'll let you think about that for a minute. Riddle me this, right? How does meekness protect our character? If I am the one responsible, let me give it over to Pastor Rick. If Pastor Rick is the one responsible for provision for our family, if Pastor Rick is the one responsible for our legacy, if Pastor Rick is the one responsible for making sure that our kids get where they need to get, have what they need to have, do all that, if that rests on his shoulders and his shoulders alone and God is not in it, then maybe he's going to walk in good character when it's just about what he needs to get. But what about when he sees his child in pain? If he can't count on God to deliver, what is he willing to do? How is it willing to compromise? I actually shouldn't have changed to him because his character is so impeccable. I should have kept it at me, heathen pig dog sinner that I am. If I have to protect my kids, if I have to guarantee their safety and security, what might I do if it's all dependent on me? But when we are meek, when we recognize that it's not dependent on us, it's dependent on God. When we don't have to earn our inheritance, when we know nobody can change the will, when we can trust the promises of God to show up for us in these spaces and places, then I don't have to try to earn it or get it or do it myself. And in that, can I just say that being meek also works and lives in harmony with being righteously angry? Oh, we're going to get to that. Let me not skip ahead. God says your worth, your value, your inheritance, I have taken care of that. The very verse that Ashley read and had no idea, it's not like Ashley saw a copy of my sermon, but the very verse she read about Jesus paying the price of our sins to give us righteousness, meekness is trusting that. Because in meekness, we can realize that nobody can take what the Father has promised. Church, nobody can take what the Father has promised you. How are we doing?
We're here.
We're here. That's a word, right? These first three Beatitudes are all about the good life, not being in the pain itself, but the realization of God's presence and promises in the pain. And I want you, think of it like this. The people who have gone through a natural disaster, right? Like there's a big hurricane coming, and it's big, like it's a Cat 4. It's a big hurricane, right? And the people that evacuate and leave and don't actually live through the storm, when they come back, they are overwhelmed with the devastation and the loss. And sometimes we can read the Beatitudes like God's encouraging us to love the devastation and the loss. The truth is, it's like the people. Now, I don't encourage this at all. As a matter of fact, I'm going to lovingly call them knuckleheads. The knuckleheads who refuse to evacuate when they're supposed to evacuate, who will disobey all the orders, and they stay and they actually live through the terrifying storm. For the ones that live, you see them on the interviews. What's their attitude? They don't care about what they've lost. They're like, I'm alive. I can rebuild. It's fine. I'm alive. And these first three Beatitudes are about realizing that you're alive, and God's been with you the whole time, and he's protected you, and you're not a knucklehead like they are. It's okay, because life happens. But because they've been through it, they are ashrei, because they recognize that the stuff doesn't matter as much as the living. And if the first three Beatitudes teach us about the places God finds us in, then the second three Beatitudes teach us about the type of character God calls us to, which, by the way, flow out of the spaces and places he meets us in. I want you to read with me Matthew 5, 6 through 8. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. That's a promise. Blessed are those, ashrei are those. The good life is for those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Righteousness is such a churchy word, which means that unchurched people have no idea what it means. It just feels old-fashioned and maybe a little judgmental. And most church people have some aversion to it because in some way it's been abused and they have church hurt that likens righteousness to rule-following or shaming or just being perfect, which none of us can be. They fear legalism. So I have some really incredibly valuable revelation for us today. This word, righteousness, the Hebrew word tzedakah, it's not about perfection or rule following. It's about relationship. It's actually the character of righteousness of someone who is in right relationship with God and therefore in right relationship with those around them. It's right living. Tim Mackey from the Bible Project says, righteousness is to be someone who does right by God, and that's to be someone who does right by other people. In a community context, righteousness is about the equity of importance. Not equity of position, not equity of financial wealth, not equity of education, not equity of importance. Because God is no respecter of your position. He's no respecter of your bank account. He's no respecter of your education or your degree. God is a respecter of who you are as his child, holy and sacred and set apart. That's what matters to him. And righteousness is about recognizing equity of importance of every human being. I think some of us need to hear today that righteousness isn't a moral code. Righteousness is how we show up for one another. It's not something I'm making up. It's what the word means. And can we pause just for a minute to talk about hunger and thirst? Because I think we gloss over this one. Like we think hunger and thirst and we think we missed a meal or we're 2 hours late for lunch and we're getting a little hangry and we should want righteousness like that. Anybody? Nobody? Or like I only had 8 ounces of water on my walk and I'm thirsty because I walked, 2 miles with only 8 ounces. Jesus is talking to a poor, destitute, oppressed culture that lives in 100 plus degree temperatures a large part of the year, who have to walk miles to a well to get water, who do go hungry, not hangry. And he says, blessed, the good life belongs to those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, not in a first world way. I don't want to downplay or diminish, guys. Look, there is a food inequality in our nation. Absolutely. There's places where the water's not great. But there has to be a very strange set of circumstances for someone in the United States to die of thirst and dehydration. And while there is definitely food inequity and we need to continue to deal with that as a nation, people aren't starving to death every day. We're talking about a culture where it was not uncommon for people to die of hunger or die of thirst. And it is in that that Jesus says, I am painting you this vivid picture that That is the pain you need to feel in order to be in right relationship. That's how important it is. As much as you hunger and thirst for food and water when it is scarce, that's how much you have to hunger and thirst for being in right relationship with me and others. Can I ask us a question? There's silence. Y'all are afraid of this question. I don't blame you, actually. I think you got my notes. When was the last time we were so discontent with the brokenness of the world and the brokenness of our communities that we thirsted for it as if our very lives depended on it? I'm proud of all that we do as a church and how we show up, how we work on right relationships with God and each other and this community and the communities that you touch in your workspaces, or like we have people who live in La Plata and Waldorf and everywhere. Like, it's not just about Indian Head, but it's how you show up and hunger and thirst. Ashray are you, because that is what you are doing. He says the good life are for those who are merciful. Are we doing all right, church? Do you need a little stretch? Like, we're almost through. Well, I need to know you're still out there. Do the wiggle. Mercy is this compassion that is composed of feelings and actions. Mercy is a response to human need, and there's a deep sense of forgiveness that is often tied to mercy. So catch this. Mercy loves generously. Mercy sees needs and lovingly, generously responds to needs. When Bartimaeus, the blind beggar, was on the road, he cried out, "Son of David, have mercy on me." And Jesus turned around and generously loved on and healed him. So yes, it's loving generosity, but again, it's also deeply rooted in forgiveness. Mercy points to forgiving someone who maybe doesn't deserve it, forgiving someone who has wronged you or owes you. Jesus teaches us this parable about this guy who owes so much money that it's literally impossible. Like, he'd have to suddenly take three kingdoms, and there are none to take. Rome has them all. Take three kingdoms to be even to begin to pay back the debt that he owes the king, right? And he asks the king for mercy, and the king gives him mercy and forgives his debt. And then the guy goes and finds somebody who basically owes him like $500 and won't forgive him, won't show him mercy, has him thrown in jail. And woe to him, the consequences were severe when the king called him back in. And so don't think that mercy isn't without forgiveness. And the fact that God has shown us mercy, taking on our sin, like we are to show mercy. And that points right back to those relationships that we talked about. And I want to pause here, guys, because I am weary. I am weary as a pastor of seeing lives ruined and relationships destroyed because we aren't willing to forgive. And I don't mean forgive because they've earned it. I mean just forgive like we have been forgiven. I watched my grandmother for years suffer from unforgiveness. She would go decades and not talk to immediate relatives, her own children. She missed the first 6 years of her grandchild's life over bitterness and unforgiveness. Even now, Rick and I watch people in our extended family suffer because they lack mercy. And when we can't be merciful, when we can't forgive, it destroys people and it destroys us internally. Eugene Peterson said to show mercy is to forgive, or forgive is extremely difficult. No one's saying it's easy. It's extremely difficult for those who have been deeply wronged, but the alternative is the self-destruction that comes from nursing grudges or seeking revenge. Desmond Tutu said, "There is no future for the human race without forgiveness. There will be no way forward for us on individual or corporate levels without the practice of forgiveness." And I want to tell you that the blessed, or the ashray, or the good life of mercy escapes the self-crippling cycle of bitterness and unforgiveness that literally rips apart the fabric of our lives. Jesus is inviting us to be merciful. And then he has one more for us that we're going to close with today. He said, the good life belongs to the pure in heart, for they will see God. Can I tell you that was a mic drop moment? Because outside of Eden, to see God meant to die. Humans aren't allowed to see the face of God. We can't handle his holiness. And Jesus is saying, in this kingdom that I'm bringing to you, those who are pure in heart, they will see God. Now, before we can get totally to the wow of that, let's talk about what it means to be pure of heart. Because in our culture, we hear heart and we hear emotions. To have pure emotions. There's no such thing as all pure emotions, by the way. But in Hebrew culture, the heart was not just the seat of emotions. It was the seat of the mind and the thoughts and the will. The heart was the seat of our internal makeup. And Jesus says, Ashrei, the good life, human flourishing belongs to those who have a purity of heart. And in that, remember that this is a Jewish culture that had found the only way to even get near the presence of the temple was to be physically pure. Ritual cleansing, washing my hands a bunch of times, doing all these things. By the way, prevented a lot of diseases. Forever, people made all this speculation that the Jewish people had some sort of witchcraft going on because they were the only ones not dying from the Black Plague. No, it was because God taught them to wash their hands so many times and actually be clean. So I'm not saying there's not a place for ritual clean, but Jesus isn't about you being ritually or physically clean. He's about the state of our hearts. Now, this very phrase is what I would call a hyperlink to a psalm. And I'm just going to give you the address. I'm not going to go into it. I encourage you, let it be one of the passages for your quiet time this week. But Psalm 24, verses 3 to 6. The people who will ascend the mountain will see the face of God when their hearts are pure. And Jesus is once again extending this invitation, saying, I am bringing you into the kingdom. I've already helped you ascend the mountain physically. Now we're going to ascend the mountain spiritually. The return of humanity that is promised ever since Eden, like the return of humanity to Eden that is promised, that state of being in God's presence, walking in with him daily. What John talks about in the future from this, in Revelation, no longer will there be any curse. The throne of God and of the Lamb will be in the city and the servants will serve him. They will see his face. And they will not die is the implication. And the upside down of it that Jesus is giving is that while you have focused on this ritual, physical cleansing, that is not what I'm about, and this kingdom isn't about that. I'm inviting you to find healing and cleanliness for the internal corruption that is destroying your soul. That your internal motivations would be right and pure. So in the kingdom, we don't do something good so that we're seen or so that we get praise. We don't give our tithes to God so that we get a check mark and he marks us as holy and all right, you're good, and we get our nice little letter from the church and feel okay when the bills get paid. And we don't share the good news of Jesus with someone and invite them into the kingdom so that when we get to the kingdom, God says, here's a reward for you in heaven because you brought someone into the kingdom. Because if we do any of those things for any of those reasons, then our motives are impure. And that is exactly what Jesus is saying he does not want. He's saying that he wants the purity of our heart, which goes back to righteousness and how we relate to God and how we relate to other people. So to be pure of heart is not pure behavior, but purity of character. So when God is challenging you in an area, when he challenges me in an area, I don't need to focus on my behavior. I need to focus on the attitude of my heart, and then my behavior will fix itself. How's your heart? How's your heart before God today? Guys, Jesus gives us so much to think about in these short little verses, where he meets us and what he wants us to do and the human flourishing of all of that. And as I close, I want to echo a little Eugene Peterson and a little Dallas Willard, because I don't want any of us to be overwhelmed by the Beatitudes. They're not a sentence. They're an invitation. Jesus isn't giving us a moral code to live up to. Jesus is giving us a blueprint of what it looks like to live as a mature disciple in the kingdom. And he's inviting us to live into that. And the bottom line that I have for us today is kind of a rephrase of that. But I think we get so caught up in doing the things, and we're being invited to a way of being, that if you don't take away anything else, I want you to understand that Jesus isn't asking us to be an architect that constructs a kingdom life. God is showing us the blueprint and inviting us, his children, to move into and live into the kingdom home that he's provided. That's what it means to be Ashrei and to live the good life.